There was a ruling out of a division of this court, CM, that controls the procedure in these types of cases. The respondent did everything he could to ensure that he would be afforded due process. He filed motions objecting to pretrial motions or pre-hearing motions, objecting to any hearsay so that he would have the ability to cross-examine or the ability to subpoena a witness. He was not afforded any of that, and there was no sufficient competent evidence pursuant to CM that allowed this case to have the kind of ruling that it did. It's our position that there was a conscious attempt to prevent the respondent to present any defense because there was no ability to know dates or persons that he was alleged to have had a sexual encounter with.
Isn't the only thing missing here the identity of the informant? And the as I understand it, the basic proof all lay with the records. How is he prejudiced if the records are the basis of the order?
Well, the records contain hearsay that is not made by somebody with knowledge.
But there are official records exceptions to the hearsay rule.
An official exception to the hearsay rule still depends on somebody with personal knowledge. And it was very clear from the testimony that it was not. Somebody was more of a scribe than somebody with personal knowledge. And the person with personal knowledge is not testifying. The disclosure of who that person is, the date, any other identification was totally withheld. That's really the issue here in a due process violation that he could not possibly present any kind of defense.
I have a quick question about the CM case.
Yes.
The parties were not the same as here, just the Department of Health, right?
The respondent is not the same party, but the Department of Health, the Attorney General, the same Attorney General who sits here today, is the same party at issue. So it's an issue preclusion. They are on notice.
Well, and that case was an unpublished case, right?
That's correct.
And so I guess I'm just confused as to how a division of this court, which wouldn't be bound, if we disagreed with that case, we wouldn't be bound by that decision, whether it be published or unpublished, that somehow issue preclusion falls into place. I mean, we're free to disagree with CM, correct?
You are, absolutely.
Well, then how is it a binding decision when it's just an unpublished opinion that's involving only one of the parties?
I think this court, of course, is free to disagree with that division. But I think because it is the same exact party presenting and being on notice that the rules of evidence do apply to these cases. They were told very specifically, and this court can, this division can disagree, but they were told very specifically that you need competent evidence and you need the rules of evidence do apply to these cases. Their argument was, the Attorney General, that the rules of evidence really didn't apply. We were exempt from this type in this proceeding. We don't have to disclose anything. And so I think because they were told very specifically, it's not an unpublished opinion that is difficult to obtain or not available, readily available. They were absolutely on notice that they can't proceed the way they did. And in fact, they proceeded the exact same way. And because the respondent in this case knew about that, tried to take steps to say, we want to make sure that there's not hearsay. We want to make sure that we know who you're calling, who you're talking about, the dates, anything to narrow it down. And that's the issue where he took all those steps. That was missing in CM. It's not missing in this case.
Can you go back to what you believe the department was required to prove and why they didn't prove that?
Under the statute, are you saying?
Yes, yes. What do you think the proof required?
The proof required that he had a sexual encounter and did not inform his partner of his HIV status.
You don't think that it would be sufficient to have proven that he had been tested positive both for HIV and syphilis and had received counseling, and then the department got more information from a person that reported that there was a sexual encounter without advisement from him as to his status, that would be sufficient to meet the requirements of the statute?
Absolutely not. I don't believe mere fact that he has tested is sufficient at all. I mean, I think that would extend to an awful lot of people in the state that they've tested positive for some sexually transmitted disease. In this case, that is not sufficient that he simply tested. It is that he did not inform his partner of his status. And I think that's really the heart of this. And that's what's missing here. And that's his ability to cross-examine this person's state of mind, this person's level of intoxication. It is the right to confront him. It's a due process claim that let me find out what you're saying, when you said it, how you said it, because what the scribe did was write something down, and we have no ability to cross-examine that because the record that came in was just the scribe who wrote something down based on what this person said, and we don't know what the questions were that led to that's the scribe's answers or notes in the record.
Didn't counsel in fact cross-examine at the hearing?
Cross-examine the person?
Yes.
Who brought the records?
Yes, and had an opportunity to voir dire. Yes. With respect to the documents.
Yes, but that is not the scribe. That is the person who brought the records in.
And your client didn't show up at one day of the hearing, is that right?
That's correct.
Do you waive due process arguments if you don't come to your own hearing?
I don't think you ever waive your due process by that would totally be saying that, well, you have to bring in every person that you've had a sexual encounter with and say, no, I told this person, I told that person. When you don't have the ability to come in and say, what is your evidence? Because I can't tell from the records that you are giving me at the last minute. I mean, and you know it's a very truncated proceeding. I mean, it's fast. And so you don't have the normal rules of evidence to ask for this, ask for that. And so when it happens very, very quickly. And so it's like, okay, please give me the information. Let me try to subpoena the person. And he was denied his right to subpoena the person to say, could you please tell us what happened then? So voir dire-ing the person who brought the records in really doesn't force him due process at all. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
All right, Ms. Mullen, you have about six minutes.
Thank you.
High tech.
Yes. Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Justine Pierce, and I represent the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. As a preliminary matter, I'd like to address the use of the Urbina versus CM case in TL's pleadings and also in the immediately preceding oral argument. As Judge Boris pointed out, it's an unpublished decision and it's not binding precedent on this court. It is It is appropriate to cite to unpublished decisions for issue preclusion, but issue preclusion does not apply in this case. And the reason is there are four requirements in order for issue preclusion to apply, but here it fails on the very first requirement, which is that the issues must be identical, and the issues are not identical in these two cases. In Urbina versus CM, the issue was whether evidence that was never admitted substantively and was only admitted for the limited purpose of showing the basis of the department's actions, whether evidence admitted for such a limited purpose can serve as sufficient evidence in support of a district court order of compliance. By contrast, what we have here is whether sufficient evidence supported the district court order of compliance where all of the evidence was substantively admitted for the truth of the matter asserted. So the issues are not the same and issue preclusion doesn't apply. Moving on to the two issues that were presented for review here by TL, the two issues are whether sufficient evidence supported the district court order of compliance and whether these special statutory proceedings afforded adequate procedural due process protections to TL. Although these are there are two issues presented here, they're both based on a single piece of evidence, this report of non-disclosure. So let's talk a little bit about that report of non-disclosure and how it came into existence. When an individual newly tests positive for HIV, the department offers something that's called partner notification services. In other words, the department will confidentially notify recent sex partners of an individual who is recently tested positive for HIV to let them know that they've been exposed to the risk of HIV infection so they can go get tested. This is crucial to the disease control duties of the department. If an individual's sex partners aren't notified that they were exposed to HIV, to the risk of HIV infection, they won't get tested. And if they don't get tested, they won't know if they're HIV positive or not. And if they don't know whether they're HIV positive or not, they won't know whether they're in turn exposing others to the risk of HIV infection. In this case, there was an individual who had newly tested positive for HIV, and the department offered that person these partner notification services. The individual decided to go ahead and take advantage of those partner notification services and participated in a face-to-face interview with a trained disease intervention specialist employed by the department. Through the course of that interview, this individual identified TL as someone he had recently had sex with, and he let the disease intervention specialist know that they had not discussed HIV or other sexually transmitted infections. But the reason he was identifying TL and saying that they didn't discuss HIV was because this individual believed that he had exposed TL to the risk of HIV infection and wanted the department's disease intervention specialist to notify TL that he should go get tested, rather than the other way around. He wasn't actually reporting TL as someone who knew he was HIV positive and failed to disclose it. It's more approaching it from the opposite direction. So the first issue, again, is whether sufficient evidence supported the district court order, and TL's only challenge under this issue is whether a report of non-disclosure is admissible, and therefore whether it can support a district court order. The department's argument is that sufficient evidence did support the district court order for three reasons. The first is, as Judge Marquez was pointing out earlier, even without the report of non-disclosure, the district court order would still be supported by sufficient evidence in the form of four other undisputed pieces of evidence. The first is that it's undisputed that TL is HIV positive and has been since September 1998. The second undisputed piece of evidence is that TL had a syphilis infection in February 2011. The third undisputed piece of evidence is a second syphilis infection in July 2012. And the fourth undisputed piece of evidence is TL's refusal to engage with the department and talk to the disease intervention specialists about how he may or may not be endangering the public health. All of these were admitted during the hearing through uncontested witness testimony through documentary evidence in the forms of exhibits 2, 3, and 4, which were admitted without objection. TL also conceded the evidence of the HIV infection and the two syphilis infections. The department's witness testified about why these four pieces of evidence would be sufficient to support a district court order, even without any report of nondisclosure happening in this case. She testified about why repeated sexually transmitted infections in an individual who is already HIV positive demonstrates public health risk. Syphilis is a highly infectious, sexually transmitted infection. Symptoms include primary lesions, which are essentially portals into a person's body. And when these portals are exposed to sexual fluids containing the HIV virus, the chances of HIV transmission are greatly enhanced. The second reason why sufficient evidence supported the district court order of compliance is because the report of nondisclosure was properly admitted as substantive evidence under at least three exceptions to the hearsay rule. So we have this report of nondisclosure that was made by this individual receiving the partner notification services. And then that report was included within an entry made by the trained disease intervention specialist who was interviewing this individual. And that entry is part of the larger database report that the department maintains as part of its disease control functions.
Ms. Pierce, excuse me for interrupting, but is there any dispute that these were official records of the department kept in the regular course of the department's business?
No, Your Honor, there's no dispute that these were official records. So TL's main challenge here is that because a department employee didn't have personal knowledge of whatever conversation may or may not have occurred between TL and this other individual, that therefore that underlying statement, that report of nondisclosure, is inadmissible. But personal knowledge is not the requiring a department employee to have personal knowledge is not the appropriate legal framework for deciding this. And in fact, there are cases related to the business records exception that state that information from outside parties can be incorporated into the business records of a business in certain circumstances. So personal knowledge, the individual who made the report certainly had personal knowledge, and that's undisputed. And that underlying statement can be incorporated and be admissible under the overall business record.
The question is the assurance of veracity.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, I think that the reason behind why the person made this statement, because he wanted to make sure that TL knew that he had been exposed to HIV infection rather than the other way around, I think that supports the overall reliability and credibility of the statement. So the department is charged with protecting the public health and exercising its disease control functions, including preventing the transmission of HIV. There are two main tools they have, which are confidentiality and encouraging disclosure. So there are some cases where, in this case, we have a mixture of different types of evidence, right? We have repeated sexually transmitted infections, and then we also have this report of nondisclosure. But there are instances where the department comes across an individual who just has repeated episodes of these reports of nondisclosure, which is a very real public health risk. So if these reports of nondisclosure were never admissible, it would seriously hamper the department's ability to protect the public health. And they need to be able to admit these reports of nondisclosure without having to disclose the identity of the individual who had recently tested positive for HIV and was receiving these partner notification services. Because without that guarantee of confidentiality, people won't take advantage of the partner notification services, and the department won't be able to let people of the state of Colorado know that they've been potentially exposed and maybe exposing others. Moving on to the second issue presented for review, it's whether adequate procedural due process protections were afforded to TL in this case. Protecting the identity of the individual who made that report of nondisclosure does not violate TL's procedural due process rights. We have to keep in mind, too, that the standard of review includes the fact that the proceedings are presumed to be constitutional, and TL must have shown that they were unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. When we're doing a procedural due process analysis, the first step is to identify a protected liberty interest. TL has never identified what that protected liberty interest is as a foundational matter, because that's Once we know what the protected liberty interest is, then we determine how much process is due. But we can infer that TL has already completed all of the counseling he was ordered to complete in this case. So what remains is that he's ordered to disclose his HIV status before he has sex. If that's the protected liberty interest, then we consider what process was provided to him. And the only thing that was necessary to be provided to him was notice and an opportunity to be heard. He received both of those things in this case. He received a disclosure of all of the documentary evidence in advance of the hearing, even though it was held in such a short period of time. And that documentary evidence included, again, the fact that he is HIV positive, the first syphilis infection, the second syphilis infection, his refusal to engage with the department, and also this report of non-disclosure. As Judge Graham pointed out, the only thing that was not provided to him was the identity of that individual who made the report of non-disclosure. There was only one witness called by the department, and that was Rebecca Jordan Yale, and TL did have the opportunity to cross-examine her. TL also had the opportunity to voir dire these records, again, as Judge Graham pointed out. The only thing he could not do was cross-examine the individual who made that report of non-disclosure, but procedural due process doesn't require this. The purpose of cross-examination is to impeach the reliability of a witness or a statement, and he could have done so by testifying himself and talking about his disclosure habits or calling any witness at all to talk about his disclosure habits. He didn't need to know the identity of that individual in order to impeach the reliability of this report of non-disclosure. And again, we have to remember that in determining what process is due to TL, we have to balance TL's protected liberty interest against the other interests in this case. And there are very strong interests in maintaining the confidentiality of that individual who made the report of non-disclosure. And there are also very strong public policy interests in ensuring that effective disclosure is taking place. The statute itself also requires confidentiality, as we covered in our answer brief. So in balancing TL's liberty interest against all of the other interests that are at stake here, the only thing that was necessary to be provided was notice and an opportunity to be heard, and he received both in this case. Those are the two points that I wanted to address, the fact that sufficient evidence did support the district court order and that adequate procedural due process protections were afforded to TL. Are there any other questions I can answer for the court? In that case, we ask that this court affirm the district court order. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pierce. Ms. Mullen?
Nothing further.
The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. Thank you again, Ms. Mullen. Thank you again, Ms. Pierce. That completes our 9 o'clock docket.